Good morning. It's official. There's a plan. The path ahead, no less. And with that, schools will be reopening. Here's 10-year-old Grace.
I'm going back on the 15th of
March. And how do you feel about that?
I'm very excited to see my friends and my teacher.
Who do you sit beside?
Well, I've been away for so long I forgot.
Oh, no.
Ah, pudding now. But with schools returning, a wee bit of progress. And there's even talk now of vaccine passports. Possibly getting ahead of ourselves, but still. On Tuesday, in the least mic drop address ever, Taoiseach Micheál Martin took to the plinth and assured us that the end is truly in sight. Sounds a little ominous. As long as we keep walking in 5K circles until April. And given the mixed, muddled and muddy government communication in the last few weeks, did the Taoiseach read the room? Alison O'Connor gave her analysis on Drive Time.
Bearing in mind, I suppose, if there was anybody sort of giving him a pep talk just before this, they'd have been saying to him, you know, OK, Micheál, this is possibly the most hostile crowd you're ever going to face. And you're delivering what is essentially a cod liver oil political speech. You know, but you're the Taoiseach, you're the leader of the country. You have to get out there and do it. You have to give people a little bit of hope. I think he tried to do that. I think he did. It was a lot of gulp, cod liver oil. But he also tried to give a little bit of hope in terms of the vaccines. Mm. I suppose one of the first things is that mercifully there was no poetry. I think nobody listening or viewing was in any mood for that. We're gone beyond that. I think the entire country is in a kind of a kick the cat space right now. Mm. So he gave lashings of empathy. There was a lot of, he flattered us, he said we'd done incredibly well, that he didn't mention how bad things were at Christmas, but he did say how well we have done, one of the best in Europe in terms of bringing everything back down, and you know, spoke about how fed up everybody must be. But then also the reality, when he mentioned about the new variants, that 95% of our infections, and therefore that's why there isn't more of a loosening up, which all of us want to see.
And it's less a case of hang your hat on dates than on community transmission and trends. On Monday's News at 1, the WHO's Mike Ryan, Executive Director of the Health Emergencies Programme, joined Brian Dobson. And given that we're so long in lockdown, Brian put this to him.
Is there any alternative?
I think we've seen the alternatives before, which was exiting lockdowns in too quickly in many, many countries and then lurching back into the same situation again. So when these are dilemmas, and there's no question that there are trade-offs between the two options. I am sure the government, I know that they are looking at a plan for living with COVID. I've been saying that myself for quite a while now. We need to get on top of the virus, get in control of this virus, move to a longer-term plan to have better control and to stop the death and the hospitalizations. Once we stop deaths and hospitalizations, this virus becomes a more normal threat and we can deal with it in a more rational and structured way. And we will have more choices to open up. But that requires now the community to drive transmission down by taking every possible precaution. This is almost like setting a challenge for ourselves. Right now, Ireland is around 1,000 cases a day. I don't believe that leaves the government with many choices right now with that number of cases a day. The positivity rate, though, is dropping. Hospitalizations are dropping. So the signs are good, but not quite good enough, maybe, to give the government the choices, the freedom of choice right now. So getting that number down right now across the country has to be a goal for everybody. Because rather than looking at dates and rather than saying, well, there's a date and we'll change, the dates don't drive anything. What drives decision-making is numbers, the number of cases, the number of deaths, the trajectory of the epidemic. And it's in everyone's control at some level to drive that number down.
No pressure on us then. And all of that before Drive Time's John Cook spoke to students in Limerick. Dex, bag of cans, the COVID, won't touch me.
I got fined the last day there, €150 for attending a house party.
How many people were in that?
About 15.
There's always going to be some parties, so like just the way it is, but I think we're being painted in a lot worse light than things actually are.
Well, we have one house we mix with sometimes, but it would only be between the two houses.
And how many people would come together then?
10.
15, 20 people probably. Like, if it hits me hard and I die, well, it's a laugh on me then. Look, it is what it is.
But, I hope that doesn't happen.
No, sure, look, I wouldn't want to transmit it to anyone else. What do you expect college students just to stay in your house, just doing your college work alone with your housemates? It's not going to happen. You're going to see college students mingling with each other as they are friends, and they're going to be drinking because we're young people. I mean, it's not really killing that many young people.
You'd almost want Mike Ryan to pay them a visit. Meanwhile, on This Week, Gavin Jennings spoke to Assistant Professor of Virology at Trinity College, Dr. Kim Roberts. As you might expect from the Gavin, it was a short, pithy question, but it was the hesitant pause in response that spoke volumes.
The plan, broadly, to lower case numbers and then to vaccinate to keep them low, will it work? Easy one to finish with.
Will it work? It's going to take time, but if we look at other respiratory virus pandemics and we think about influenza pandemics, the first 18 months, 2 years are really, really hard. But then the pressure on the healthcare system reduces because there is an element of acquired immunity. It's not herd immunity, but acquired immunity. And we have the added benefit of having vaccines as well. So I'm really hopeful that things will start getting back to normal, but it's not going to be this year. It's going to take a bit of time.
Well, let's pretend we didn't hear that. Vaccines, vaccines, vaccines. Because the Taoiseach did make the assertion that the target of having 60% of the country's adults fully vaccinated by the end of June might be achievable. And that assertion had factored in the fallen supply of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Now, we'll get to our nearest neighbours in a bit, well done. But what about other fellow EU countries? How come some are doing better than others? Denmark, for example. They're aiming to have the entire population vaccinated by June 27th. Now, yes, they're well organised and have a really good healthcare system. And they're giving as many people as possible one initial jab and then working on the second. And they made the decision early on to put all their chips on the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. Here's Naomi O'Leary, Irish Times Europe correspondent, with Sarah on Drive Time.
They've been ahead of most EU countries from the very beginning because they prepared early on the assumption that they would be rolling out these Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. And the other thing is that they've actually managed to get a few additional doses as well under the EU system. They took up slack because other countries turned down some Pfizer and Moderna doses. They didn't take up the doses they could have, and Denmark bought them.
Really? People were turning down vaccines?
Yeah, Pfizer and Moderna weren't particularly popular options for many EU countries because they're very expensive and they're tricky to roll out, trickier than AstraZeneca, which can be stored at a colder temperature. And so a good few countries really planned on the assumption that they would be using AstraZeneca as the backbone of their vaccination campaigns and weren't that keen to buy the more expensive Pfizer and Moderna ones, which are also based on a less familiar technology. And those countries that made that plan have really suffered with the the manufacturing slowdown with AstraZeneca, where they're actually able to deliver only a fraction of what was promised.
So if we're all ladling from the same EU vaccine pot, just how did this happen?
It's slightly obscure. There's a little bit of mystery about which countries turned down doses and which took extra. We know that Denmark took extra. Obviously, the countries that turned down doses, may not want to say that publicly because it will cause a political problem for them. So it's a little difficult to get to the bottom of it because those figures aren't public. But we know that Denmark did get extra doses that way. Also, it could be a factor that they were very early on saying, give us all those doses. We want absolutely every last dose as soon as we can. So possibly they were able to lock down doses earlier that way, but it's a little bit obscure.
Well, to take the obscurity off it, on Wednesday, Cormac spoke to Shona Murray, Europe correspondent with Euronews, to see how Ireland had fared. We had received our allocation, but had we hustled for more?
And did Ireland get in on this, the mad scramble to get the vaccines that weren't being taken up?
Well, of course, this is the question that which is outstanding, because I've spoken to a few sources about this and they said Ireland does have a comparably, successful vaccine rollout program. And they have said that Ireland has and at least maxed out what its pro rata allocation was, but in some cases did buy excess. And as someone, it's very hard to get the exact information by to what exact amount we did. But someone had just said to me the moments ago, if you look at what Ireland's pro rata allocation was and what it's ordered, it did max it out, but we just don't know exactly how much. And it's interesting that we haven't heard this before, because you'd think that the government would be making a point that it did all it could to get as much out of vaccines as possible.
Yeah, now the Minister, Stephen Donnelly, was telling the Dáil earlier that he has enough vaccines ordered to vaccinate over 10 million people. So it presumably Ireland will have excess as well.
Maybe, assuming we can get the order filled. On Thursday evening, EU leaders had a long video conference. Vaccine passports, green lanes, and yes, supply was on the agenda. Here's Tony Connolly with Áine on yesterday's Morning Ireland.
Last night, you know, there was a lot of talk about the vaccine question, the rollout. Ursula von der Leyen was questioned quite intently by EU leaders about the contracts with pharmaceutical companies, the idea of ramping up production, not just in the pharmaceutical companies themselves, but, you know, other rival pharmaceutical companies could get involved in helping produce larger numbers. But again, you have a problem with the messaging behind this and the fact that there are thousands and thousands of doses of AstraZeneca vaccines which have arrived in member states which simply aren't being used because there is this hesitancy around the AstraZeneca vaccine, especially in the over 65s. So that is a concern that leaders were discussing last night as well.
And Sean Michel, the council president, warning supply will be difficult for a few weeks to come. So there are no quick fixes for this for any of the EU leaders coming out of that video conference.
No, I mean, I think there's been a recognition that the first quarter and the first 3 months of this year have just been very difficult in terms of the contractual problems with companies like AstraZeneca, Pfizer, BioNTech. And then each member state have their own arrangements for rolling out vaccines. And of course, the Commission from the start has been saying, look, these things need to be coordinated. We need to make sure the rollout is happening as quickly as possible. But if the flow is being hampered at source, in other words, if the deliveries aren't being made, then that has held the whole thing up. But there is an expectation that in the second quarter, there will be much higher volumes coming into the system and some of those bottlenecks might start to be freed up.
Well, one place where there was no bottleneck was up the way and across the sea in the UK. Flying at it, aren't they? Not that we begrudge them. Of course not. You'd need to be fierce mean to begrudge them that. Inda Brady of Sky News talked to Claire on Monday about his visit to a vaccination centre in West London. What was it like?
It was amazing, actually. Super efficient, very, very quick, a very slick operation. Everyone there knew exactly what their role was, what their task was on the day. And it was all about getting the flow of people in and out very, very quickly. No hanging around, no waiting, no loitering, no chit-chat. It was very, very efficient. And I have to say, it was very impressive to watch. People were just in and out. And it was just like, get in, with your registration card, your letter, a quick chat with the doctor, get the jab and then move on. There was no idling around, and that is what they've done to their credit here. It has been absolutely extraordinary.
And there are over 17.5 million people vaccinated now in the UK.
With the first dose, yes. Obviously a much, much smaller number of people have had the second jab, but overall they're looking now at one third of all adults across the UK having had at least one jab of the vaccine. And the plan now is to keep it going and offer the jab to all adults by the end of July.
And yesterday it was announced that over 500,000 people in Northern Ireland had got the jab. So with that level of rollout, even the HSE's Paul Reid admitted to a certain wistful longing.
It feels as though they're returning back to some sort of normal much quicker than we will be. And we all feel vaccine envy here. Do you understand that? Do you feel that as well when it comes to our supply, when you see what's going on, even north of the border?
Every day, Claire, every day. I would love that we had the supply element that the UK has. We have worked through a process which has served the country well in the past through EU for medicines, for supplies of drugs, for pricing, and it served as well. And that's the process we're working through right now. But certainly, yeah, it is challenging when we're compared, particularly just north of the island in the north of Ireland.
Ah, challenging, that most beloved of euphemisms. Ryan, on the other hand, no, he's calling it straight.
Do you know how much we want to go and see a gig and how desperate we would just see a bit of live music? Even three people with an empty can of beans and a spoon. When I find myself in times of trouble, you go, yes, I'm going to the bar again. Anyway, music festivals are back in the United Kingdom. Damn, damn them to hell. I mean, good luck to them, but still, I have to hide my fury and rage and envy.
Or what about this texter who won't be letting the Brits wipe our eye?
And Arthur says the announcement by Boris was not based on scientific advice and may come back to bite him. I prefer the Irish government's approach of under-promising and over-delivering. Anyway, just watch this space come June. Okay, we're also reading different newspapers. But thanks, Arthur. And that is... that's great. Need a bit of satire in our lives anyway. 51551 is...
Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Wednesday's Liveline, Katie, in for Joe, spoke to Frida, whose knowledge and cool head had saved a life. She runs a B&B, and a couple with a very young baby had checked in.
On that day, which was unusual, we heard screaming from the downstairs hallway. We weren't quite sure what was happening. It was unusual for us because it's normally quiet here. And I went into the hallway to find the parents of the baby. The mum was, they were both deeply distressed, and the mum was screaming, "She's gone, she's gone." And the dad was, "She's gone, she's gone." And I said, "Who? What?" You know, it took me a few moments to realise the dad had the baby under one of his arms, and then he showed me the baby.
So this is a tiny baby now, 4 weeks old.
Yes, just tiny little baby. Was just over 6 pounds born, so very, a tiny little baby. But there was absolutely no response whatsoever from her. Her little chest was gone flat, her little tummy was gone flat. There was absolutely no response whatsoever. There was no breathing, no nothing. And she had gone kind of a blue-grey colour. And I knew there was no air in her lungs because I could see that her little chest was gone completely flat. So
now you sound like you're very competent in this very, what would be a hugely panicky scenario for most people. Are you medically trained, Frida?
I think the adrenaline just kicks in. You just go into flight or fight mode and the adrenaline just kicks in and you have to do something.
Now, Frida had worked as a care worker back in the 90s, and by pure chance, she'd recently done a CPR course, including infant CPR.
Done mouth-to-mouth, just gave three little, very light breaths until I seen her chest just rise slightly. Well, I said, at least she's getting a little bit of air, a little bit of oxygen. And then I started doing CPR, which is just your two first fingers into the centre of the chest, just below the chest bone. And I just continuously counted 1, 2, 3, 4. You just continuously count, keep going until you get a response. And even if you don't get a response, keep going until emergency services come. That's the thing. But now, it did take a while. She didn't respond immediately. I was working on her. Well, I worked on her for 15 minutes. Now, it took a few minutes before I could even see her colour starting to change. And with a newborn baby, of course, I could see... First, she was a blue-grey colour, and the first thing I could see was that her colour changed her head. She went red, and I could see the blood starting to come back down to her little veins and go up through her veins in her neck. Then she went a completely pale colour. I knew she was very, very weak. Mm-hmm. And, I was still working on her for another few minutes before, and she did open her eyes, and she gave a very little weak cry, but I knew she was extremely weak. But she did come to for me.
Frida, the relief must have been unbelievable.
Well, you know, it was afterwards. The first 24 or 48 hours, I couldn't even think about what happened. I was praying for her that she was going to keep going and come through. And she did, thankfully. And it was really only 4 or 5 days later I started to think about what had happened.
Well, let me tell you, Frida, I want you around if ever I'm in a crisis. That's for sure.
I think we all want Frida around, a remarkable woman. That was Wednesday's Liveline. this week saw one of the biggest hauls of cocaine in Europe. 23 tons were found in tins of putty held in shipping containers in the ports of Hamburg in Germany and Antwerp in Belgium. Mary Wilson spoke to Michael O'Sullivan, director of the Maritime Analysis and Operations Centre, which coordinates anti-drug smuggling in Europe.
This is a massive seizure. You know, if you want to put a street value on this, it could be, you know, anything between 1.5 billion to close to 3 billion. And it is, as you say, on an industrial scale, the highest level of drug importation is by containerized traffic. So what happens here is the organized crime group working in South America gets its ducks lined up effectively and manages to get the drugs onto the transport, onto the containers, and lines up people in the various ports to import the drugs under the radar. Now, it's a very challenging thing to do. Very often, the organized crime groups get people to the ports to intimidate dockers and the various freight handlers with a view to getting the containers in safely. And when they manage that, the profits are absolutely massive. However, when law enforcement get there first, they suffer huge, huge losses. However, the way it's structured is that the people in South America don't lose any money. This stuff is paid for. This stuff is paid for well in advance, and the people in Europe take all the risk. So they take the risk for the shipment and for the actual physical importation.
The cocaine had originated in Paraguay and its destination was the Netherlands. But to intercept drugs, given the scale of the smuggling operation, not easy.
9 containers are offloaded every minute in Rotterdam. They were getting more successful at intercepting them in Rotterdam, so the organised crime groups moved into Antwerp. Mm. And now these containers, it's sort of a new development, were sent into Hamburg. You know, they're going further up the line. Organized crime groups are constantly testing the defenses of law enforcement, looking for weak links, constantly trying to find an easy way in. And once they do that, they flood the market and flood the system.
Michael, is the pandemic helping or is it hindering the smuggling of drugs?
We have found since March the pandemic has resulted in an increase. I think the organised crime groups are operating on the principle never waste a good crisis. So what they're doing is they're sending in as many shipments as possible. In the very recent past, working with the Spanish, we seized 4 vessels in 48 hours, which is unheard of. Last year, I think we intercepted 23 vessels. And this year alone, 4 or 5 vessels, and we intercepted a plane as well. So it is all about market forces. There's a massive demand in Europe, and the market, I would estimate, is 13 billion in Europe for cocaine alone. So huge production in South America. They need to get it to Europe, to the markets of Europe, to make the money. And they will use any means possible. And they're quite ruthless in what they do.
Michael O'Sullivan with Mary on Thursday's Morning Ireland. Blood Axe Books are the publishers behind a series of highly successful poetry anthologies, the latest of which is the 4th edition of Staying Human. Editor Neil Astley joined Olivia O'Leary on the poetry programme.
You've always made it clear that you wanted to publish poetry books that would appeal to people who don't normally read poetry, who would like to find something relevant to their own lives. When you started to do that, were you accused of dumbing down?
Exactly. Some of the poetry elitists didn't like that idea. Also, the fact that the way to do it was actually to get endorsements from people who are kind of role models in different areas of culture. So when Staying Alive came out, we got quotes from people like Jane Campion, the filmmaker, John Berger, Mia Farrow, all people that we knew were mad keen on reading poetry themselves. And getting their endorsements really helped get those books out there. And then when we launched the American edition of Staying Alive in New York, Meryl Streep led the reading by poets and actors. And she then gave us an endorsement for the second anthology, Being Alive. And those endorsements really helped us get poetry out to people that don't normally read poetry, people who have often been put off by poetry at school. Poetry taught in schools years ago wasn't taught in the kind of lively way it is now. You didn't have poets in schools. So there is a kind of big readership out there that we were trying to reach, who engage with language in different kinds of areas, you know, who read the literary novel, who go to the theatre, cinema and so on, but weren't reading contemporary poetry. And those anthologies have actually pushed out to that much broader readership of people that are interested in the use of language and work that connects with them in their lives. And, you know, that's really made a difference.
And Bloodaxe also published this poet who has a very interesting background.
People love hearing Imti as Darker, the Pakistani-born poet who describes herself as a Scottish Muslim Calvinist. Is the richness of the background she draws on which appeals? And is it also maybe the flash of humour?
Yeah, the flash of humour, the humanity, the fact that she's writing as someone who grew up in Scotland and then she eloped to India with a Hindu. She was disowned by her family. Then she came back to Britain and she now lives in London. And she has that perspective in her work of a life of transitions, a life of not knowing where you belong. We're going to hear a poem shortly where she writes about her father and her father trying to fit in as a Pakistani who's moved his family to Scotland and trying to somehow become Scots. There's a lovely humour in the way that she describes her father looking at a lock and saying words that sound both from his own language and also Scots English.
So this is Chaudhry Sher Mubarak, Looks at the Loch. Light shakes out the dish rag sky and scatters the water with sequins. Look, hen, says my father, Loch Lomond, as if it were all his doing, as if he owned it. Laird of Lomond, Laird of the language. He's proud to say hen, and even more loch, with an och, not an ock, to speak proper Glaswegian like a true-born Scot, and he makes the right sound at the back of the throat because he can say hush and chwab and chamosh, because the sounds for happy and dream are the words that swim in the water for him. So he says it again. Hen, look, the loch.
From the poetry programme. It was announced this week that Hillary Clinton is teaming up with thriller writer Louise Penny to write a book entitled State of Terror, which follows a novice Secretary of State. None of which will be news to Clinton puppet master Ryan.
I think it's a great idea. I've met Hillary Clinton a couple of times, three or four times at this stage. And the first time I met her, we were sitting down, getting the hair and makeup, and we were shooting the breeze. And I said to her, you've got great people around you, by the way. And she said, thank you. I said, isn't it so important? I said, you know, to have good people around you in what you do for a living. She said, yeah. I said, it actually reminds me of an excellent book I've just finished called The Boys in the Boat. But she looked at me, she said, you've read The Boys in the Boat? I said, yeah, I think so. She goes, my husband and myself, that's one of our favourite books of all time. I said, really? And we had this moment where when you meet somebody and you click over books, it doesn't happen very often, but when it does,
magic.
You're just really like each other. It's a strange thing. You just go, all right. So we got into talking about books until somebody eventually said, you know, you have to do an interview. Oh, yeah.
Ooh, I think we have a connection. Call me. She did.
So the next time she came over then, she very kindly got in touch and said, look, do you want to, will we do another chat? And I said, we would absolutely love to. We got a chat going in, it was the Merion Hotel. We sat down together. And at the end of the interview, I said, so who are you reading at the moment? And she said, oh, I just love Louise Penny. I went on to buy a couple of her books on to see what it was that interested, because Louise Penny is the writer that she is now going to write this thriller with, as it turns out.
Go on.
So I said, I said to the lads this morning, I think I spoke to her about books at the end of the last interview we had at one point. Well, we've done one since. But anyway, at this interview that we had back in June, 3 years ago. And this is how the conversation went.
What about you, though? I'd love to see a good old thriller out of you, because I think that... Whoa. No, I really mean that, because you've seen and heard some seriously heavy, crazy stuff.
Crazy,
right?
Stuff, right?
And the world we're living in at the moment just is, feels like...
This defies my imagination. It's so weird
who
right
needs,
now.
Who needs fiction anymore?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it feels like we're living it, doesn't it? But you have written some serious and important books, and one wonders, is there a part of you would love to write the novel, be it as anonymous or in your own right?
I think you've given me an idea.
We're in Ireland. Start writing.
Yeah, we're in Ireland. Start writing. Yeah, go back to my garret and begin to do that.
OMG, he says it, she does it. Ryan Tubridy, he walks amongst us. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Conor Pope was in with Ray and he talked about an unusual problem he'd encountered. A man had contacted him via the Irish Times about Revolut, and his card had been blocked, and his surname was Ryan.
He started getting these messages from Revolut going, can you tell us if you're related to Eamon Ryan? And he was like, what? Why do you want to know that? And they said, no, can you tell us if you're related to Eamon Ryan? And this over and back went on for days and days and days until eventually they locked his account because he just refused to answer whether or not he was related to Eamon Ryan, the Green Party leader.
Yeah. His surname was Ryan.
His surname was Ryan. Now, I know his first name, but I'm not going to reveal his first name because that's not neither here nor there. Yeah. And eventually, you know, so he had no idea what had happened. He was locked out of his Revolut account for the guts of a fortnight. And I contacted them and they said, oh, yeah, that's because Eamon Ryan is what's known as a politically exposed person. And under money laundering legislation, we have to establish certain things in case the person who's on our Revolut account is linked to Eamon Ryan, and there's this really convoluted thing. And I was just thinking, like, if you're a politician and your name is Murphy, Jim Murphy.
But Ryan is a very common name as well.
Ryan is a very common name.
Revolut has 1.2 million customers in Ireland.
Exactly. So
surely there must be more
Ryans. Must there be?
Yes.
And I did put that to them. I was wondering how many people had, with a similar name, had been similarly blocked, but they haven't really gone into that detail. They're just saying they're following the rules.
I'm just thinking, O'Brien. Like, there's a O'Brien is a common name. There's a
absolutely
Dara O'Brien,
MacDonald,
O'Donoghue. O'Donoghue.
But the funny thing is, it doesn't just impact on senior politicians. It goes all the way down through the ranks. And as I say, it was brand new to me. It's just bizarre, frankly. And I plan to do more on it because I think we need to learn more about this particular story.
Bizarre is right. And then Ray, obviously gearing up for the great joke call out.
Hello, Revolut here. We're just wondering, are you related to the Pope?
Oh, well.
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's the first time I've ever heard that joke, Ray.
I know, but it was, come on, for topicality, you have to give me a few marks for that. You have to give me a few marks for, come on.
I'll give you 4 out of 10.
Okay, right.
Slightly plaintive tone off Ray, and he still only got 4. Harsh. But on Friday, Ray was joined by Dustin and Alison Spittle, and they put the call out for Ireland's funniest joke.
I think there's like a big Irish tradition though of like either being able to tell a joke or do a song, and to be honest with you, Ray, I can do neither.
That's not true. You're a great singer.
You gave him that one, Alison.
I flew into that one, Ray.
Dog is no nose, Ray. Come on, give me the line. Come on, my dog is no nose, Ray.
Why is he no nose?
No, how does he smell? My dog is no nose, right?
But how does he smell?
Terrible. What's red and invisible? No tomato. Here, come here. Did you see that new movie about the tractor? No, I only saw the trailer for it. Here, Stephen Donaldson, the Minister for Health.
Brutal. Ireland's funniest joke. It's on. Financial advisor Owen McGee was on with Claire, and that new car smell, not worth it.
The reality is that cars are one of those things that we tend to are happy to borrow money for. They're such a waste of money. Like, I love cars, Claire. Like, it's one of my things. People ask me, what's the biggest financial mistake you make? I buy cars. That's my biggest thing. But the reality is, to get those 0% interest rates, let's think about the interest rate. To get a 0% interest rate, typically you have to buy a brand new car. In the first 2 years of a car's life, it loses somewhere between 40 and 70% of its value, depending on the model. So if you think about it, let's just round that off to 50%. If you buy a 2-year-old car, someone else took that 50% hit, not you. So 0% might seem attractive, but it's actually not when you look under the bonnet.
Owen, what brings you joy, though? Isn't that the question?
Life is about living, Claire. Like, absolutely.
And I'm not into new cars either. But, you know, for some people, driving out of the showroom is the best thing that's going to happen to them over the course of 10 years. So, you know, I know you're all about the finance, but let's not take away the joy.
But Claire, I have seen that. Like when I'm in studio with you and you look across the table at me, you're kind of like, he's as tight. I'm not tight. Right? I've seen you. I've seen the face on you sometimes. You're going, oh my God, does he live at all? Honestly, right? Good financial planning is more about the idea of spending your money on things that are important to you and not spending your money on things that aren't. And that new car smell lasts 15 minutes before the kids get into the car and wreck it. Like, don't be paying for it for years.
A blow for petrol heads out there. But pleasures we can enjoy without money and even in lockdown are sleep and food. First up, sleep with Bjorn Regan.
It's Bjorn, Madden Haran, Gunu Shoin, Pay Am Gunu Shoin, Agas Nach Mach Ain, Hine Egumle, not Ainy than Thorson. On son, Le Braham Le Cupola, Nas Nather Munin Jellish and Dian Glassall, Hashana Esker Fad Milanacher, Dian Glassall,
Dian Glassall,
Dian Glassall,
Dian
Glassall,
Dian Glassall,
Dian Glassall, Dian Glassall, Dian Glassall, Dian Glassall, Yeah, so beige if we went to get it in Lishan. I'm a guy, the Anna Lua, a gumprod, Lishanam, Gunairoin, Eginer Shachtene, Nura Hicken, Grev Cad Machine, Gum, Fnachtin to Gadina Caraclog.
That's the snoozy colour snow covered. Now to lovely eating.
Professore, ma lei i cappelletti o i tortellini come vengono conosciuti lì fuori dall'Italia? Ha qualche segreto per la sua ricetta? Come li fa?
Io non ho ricette perché devo confessare che non cucino.
Oh, paparazzi, bambino, mozzarella. No idea what they're saying, but it's so beautiful. And fingers crossed it's not libelous. That was the opening of Culture File on Tuesday. Restaurateur Giorgio Casari and culinary historian Massimo Montanari talked about a cookbook often described as the first gospel of Italian food. Pellegrino Artusi, so I'm really enjoying the accent, science in the kitchen and the art of eating well.
Pellegrino Artusi, he was a man, not a cook. He was a gastronomer, he loved the food, and in 1891 he published a recipe book that was intended not only as a recipe book in itself, but as a sort of political project for the unification of Italy. Because he thought that the new country, Italy at the time was a very new country, needed to have a book for collecting together all recipes, traditions from all regions, mainly from all families. He had not origin market products, but only products, good products from the country. He does not mention a kind of meat, a kind of ham, but only a good meat, a good ham. Many Artusi's recipes can still be made today, and they are, in fact, made. They were made by our grandmothers.
Oh, beautiful. That was Culture File on Tuesday. This week saw Daft Punk announce that they were putting away their robot helmets after 28 years at the decks and 6 Grammy Awards. Musician Dahi O'Droni is a fan and he joined Sean Rocks to celebrate the amazing music they'd produced. And his love affair with the French electronic duo began with one album in particular.
When I came across Discovery in 2001, it was just such a massive kind of turning point for me. It was suddenly like dance music that kind of really, really made sense to me. It was so unbelievably euphoric. Like Discovery is like, if somebody had never heard dance music before, Discovery is the album that you should show them, because it has this incredible kind of thesis for dance music, which is basically, you know, you find a sample or a loop or a repeated phrase and you say it long enough and sharp enough and kind of repetitive enough that it becomes this big, euphoric, profound kind of feeling. And Discovery is an absolutely perfect example for that.
And speaking of samples, Sean played this Eddie Johns song, One More Spell on You, which Daft Punk had taken for a song I bet you'll know.
So how would you describe, Dahi, for us, what Daft Punk did there in terms of taking the original piece of music and then sampling it in a way that they really do make it their own?
It's really amazing. Like, I mean, they're a perfect example of this idea of sampling, which, you know, throughout time, kind of people have kind of mixed feelings on it. You know, some people kind of say that it's like lifting something that somebody else created and kind of robbing it almost. But like Daft Punk are a perfect example of this thing where you take something beautiful and you rebuild it in another style and make something else beautiful out of it, which I think is a really, really good thing to do, you know. And throughout that kind of album, you'll hear it like there's littered with just like loads of these amazing, like kind of almost unheard of kind of samples from the 70s and 80s that they took in, then they mixed them with these like really, really intense, hard French house kind of kick drums and almost like these big, heavy live drums behind it. And suddenly it has this like repetitive, big, like build up of kind of euphoria. And like, I mean, you just have to listen to even that tiny sample. And like, I find it hard to imagine that anybody couldn't enjoy that, you know? And I know you guys played Digital Love last night. Yeah. And like, it's such a, like, you just have to turn it on. I mean, it doesn't really need that much explanation, you know? It's just so positive and uplifting and happy, you know?
Uplifting and happy? We'll take a bit of that. Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. One more time.